Hello everyone and welcome to this new session of Memcast. From last week's episode where we spoke about escalation of care principles behind it and how to help you make a decision and communicate that to the intensive care team, we are going to discuss this in practice today. We're very happy to be joined once again by Dr. Latif Rahman. And we're going to carry on the discussion from last week and give you a few clinical cases that we hope are going to be helpful. Again, thank you so much for joining us today, Latif. Now, because we have the basics of what should we bear in mind when assessing an unwell patient on the ward, should we start the cases?
Absolutely.
So our first case, we're talking about a 70-year-old man that's known to have COPD and was admitted with worsening shortness of breath and productive cough. He was treated for an acute exacerbation with steroids, oral antibiotics, and given oxygen therapy as well. Observations on arrival were stable. His past medical history includes COPD, as it was previously mentioned, heart failure, but we're not given further details about the degree of heart failure, and diabetes on insulin. And he also has a AAA that's been under surveillance. His exercise tolerance is about 20 yards. He's stopped by shortness of breath, and he lives with his daughter that helped him with all his care. A periarrest is called because the patient becomes quite drowsy in an acute medical ward, and the nurses are finding it very difficult to wake him up. An A2E assessment is done by one of the doctors, and his airway is maintained. His rest rate is about 12 rests per minute, and his SATs are 97% on 15 liters. We're not given more information about that, but we are given a blood gas that was done on 15 liters of oxygen that shows a pH of 7.2, a PO2 of 10, a PCO2 of 9, a bicarb of 28, a base excess of plus 3.2, and a lactate of 2. On the AFPU scale, he's only responsive to pain, and his GCS is currently 10 out of 15. Having this information in mind, what would you think the escalation of care would be? What would be the most suitable escalation of care for this patient? We're also told that his clinical frailty score is about 7, given the history we've been given.
Thanks, Christina. So basically, it's a very interesting case, and it fits nicely with what we have discussed so far. So for the first question, as we wanted to answer, is ITU or HDU referral needed in the first place? So what do we want from them? And obviously, I think the question is, we want to refer to them because the patient has got a low GCS, and this patient has got a type 2 respiratory failure, which appears decompensated. So the main question we would want them to answer is airway protection needed, and also, is NIV needed? And to answer that question, we need to do the basics first. So we have done a very good ABCD assessment, and we can clearly see that the patient is saturating more than the patient should. Even though the PO2 is 10 kilopascals, but the saturations are 97% on 15 liter, and somebody who's got a decompensated type 2 respiratory failure from COPD, you would want the saturations to be 80 to 92. Is the patient bronchospastic? In which case, do we need to give back-to-back NEBs? Do we need to give a bit of steroids? So I think different trusts may have different protocols, but our trust has this protocol where anybody with a decompensated type 2 respiratory failure, you would ideally aim to give 1 hour of medical therapy before deciding on the need for NIV, because 1 hour of medical therapy can drastically change the patient's, you know, overall medical state or condition. So give controlled oxygen, back-to-back NEBs, steroids, and also if the patient needs some antibiotics. So a bit of basic treatment for the next 1 hour. I presume the periarrest call has gone out. So ITU would already become aware, and that's really useful because even though you're giving 1 hour of medical treatment, it might still be useful to inform ITU early that we've got a patient here who has got this decompensated type 2 respiratory failure, and we are giving some medical treatment, but the patient may end up needing NIV. So we have already decided that a higher level of escalation would probably be needed, but then the most important question, is it actually in the best interest of the patient? And this is where we need to look at the patient's physiological and functional baseline, and whether the benefits of an ITU admission would outweigh the harm. And in this case, my personal opinion would be somebody who's got a frailty score of 7, and it's a really powerful score. So if it's done properly, it can give a lot of information about patients who are elderly. So in our trust, we always encourage a detailed clinical frailty score to be documented as accurately as possible on admission for elderly patients. So with the patient's clinical frailty score of 7, with their exercise tolerance being only 20 yards. And it's very useful that you have said that it's due to shortness of breath and not due to, for example, something like an osteoarthritis, which has a complete different meaning. So if their shortness of breath is what is limiting their exercise tolerance, and they have got comorbidities in the form of heart failure, diabetes, heart failure, and I presume the COPD would be longstanding. Otherwise, it's more likely given the fact that they have decompensated into type 2 respiratory failure. Having said that, people with a new COPD can still be over-oxygenated into a decompensated type 2 respiratory failure. But I presume the COPD would be longstanding, but we need more information. With all this in context, an ITU admission would probably inflict more harm than benefit. And as medics, you are entitled to take that decision yourself. But if you're confused, you can always discuss with your seniors or even the ITU team. They would often be willing to help you if needed. And in terms of the overall prognosis, I think it would be best for the patient to be managed in a ward setting or HDO or acute care bay, whichever you have in your trust, which would give NIV in a close monitored state, but not need ITU.
Perfect. Thank you so much. Yeah, that's quite the common case, actually, that we tend to manage as medical registrars. So this is very useful, and it shows the importance of taking an accurate history when the patients come in and using scales like clinical frailty score, which, again, is very useful for our listeners to actually revise and have a look at. Now, the second case is slightly different. We're talking about a 30-year-old male with no past medical history that's admitted with a community acquired pneumonia that's classified as a CURB 65 of 2. He has an acute kidney injury with a urea of 9 millimoles per liter and a blood pressure of 80 systolic in the emergency department, and he's quite tachycardic with it. He's managed with IV boluses, and his blood pressure recovers and is more than 90 systolic. He's sent to a ward and continues treatment with IV antibiotics. One day into admission, he's in one of the acute medical units, and he becomes less responsive. Blood pressure is found to be 60 systolic, and nurses report no urine output for more than 10 hours. His ABG is done on 15 liters of oxygen, which the nurses have put him on, and that shows a pH of 7.1, a PO2 of 20, a PCO2 of 3, bicarbonate of 12, a base excess of -6, and a lactate of 6. Obviously, the medical team is very concerned about him, and they're thinking about the best place for him for his escalation of care. What do you think about this patient?
Thanks, Christina. So again, a really nice case, which will again nicely fit into the pattern we have been discussing so far. So first of all, again, if the patient had a completely perfect baseline, and if everything else was not a factor, in itself, the condition, does it warrant ITU admission? And the main issue which will answer this question is, does the patient need vasopressors right now? And that will be defined by whether the patient needs more fluids or not. So anybody who is hypotensive in the context of a sepsis, which seems likely in this case, would only need vasopressors if we define them as to have septic shock. And septic shock, as you would know, is defined as a hypotension or a circulatory insufficiency or hemodynamic instability in the context of sepsis, which hasn't responded to IV fluid treatment. So as medics, again, we go back to the basic ABCD assessment and answer this question: have we given enough fluids to this patient? And if we have given enough fluid to this patient, then obviously the patient is still hemodynamically unstable and so in septic shock and would need vasopressors. So we have answered our question: yes, transfer to level 2 or level 3 would be needed. Yeah. And then you said the patient is less responsive. Does this mean the patient can't maintain their airway, or it's just a bit drowsy?
So he's a bit drowsy, I think, in context of his blood pressure rather than any airway compromise at this point in time.
Fabulous. So at this moment, we have one organ which we know definitely needs organ support. So that would be the hemodynamic organ system, so circulatory organ system. And then the next question is the patient is not producing enough urine output. That is, again, what we need to understand is whether that's reversible or not. If the lack of urine output is secondary to renal hypoperfusion, secondary to circulatory insufficiency, then the kidneys do not necessarily need organ support, in which case we are down to only one organ support need, which is the circulatory support. And in this case, as we discussed, a level 2 escalation would probably be appropriate. On the other hand, if the kidney ends up needing support as well, then you end up needing two organ supports, which in which case you need to escalated to ITU, which is level 3. Now, having decided that an ITU or HDU escalation, so we have decided it's needed, the next question is it actually in the best interest of the patient? And from what you have said, it's a 30-year-old male who doesn't appear to have any significant comorbidities, till we presume otherwise it's the best of functional baseline, so they're fit and well, in which case they won't be necessarily harmed too much by an ITU admission, but have got a lot to gain. So in this case, I would definitely escalate it to level 2 or level 3. Whether it's level 2 or 3 depends on the number of organ supports they would need. Just another one very quickly, Christina. In the first case, you use somebody who's 90-year-old, and in the second case, you use somebody who's 30-year-old. And age is very complicated in terms of critical care escalation. And I think it might be useful to talk a bit about age. So the first thing that all medics need to keep in mind is age itself, without any other thing, is not determinant in whether you would refer somebody to ITU or not. So you can't decide on escalation just purely based on age. If a 90-year-old had the same baseline and same comorbidities as somebody with 6-year-old, then just because they're 90 and just because somebody's 60 should not make any difference in terms of escalation to critical care. So age itself is not a determinant if everything else is the same. Having said that, age itself might come with a few age-associated comorbidities. And if the comorbidities that come with age would dictate your ITU escalation or HDU escalation decisions, then it will be based on those comorbidities which come with age rather than just with age. I hope I made that quite clear, because what you don't want is why have we referred somebody who's 90-year-old to ITU? That should never be said. So it's all about the comorbidities and the baseline. But I think going back to this case, this is somebody who's fit and well, needs ITU and would benefit from ITU or HDU. And whether it's HDU or ITU depends on the number of organ supports they would need. But first, we must do the basics. So ABCDE, making sure that they actually need HDU or ITU. And that would only be decided once we have convinced ourselves that the patient's circulatory status is refractory. Circulatory insufficiency is refractory to IV fluid treatment.
Okay. That actually goes nicely with our last case. We're talking about a 90-year-old, so 90-year-old male that's admitted to a care of the elderly ward for management of his back pain after a fall. I want to mention that he had a discussion on arrival to A&E about the fact that he doesn't want to be resuscitated and he doesn't want to be escalated to intensive care unit in case of need. About his social history, he lives with his family, his daughter helps him with all activities of daily living, but he's able to mobilize with the stick. He has pubic rami fracture and he's kept in for analgesia and physiotherapy. 7 days into admission, his GCS drops suddenly to 9 out of 15. Drug history, as one of the juniors looked through the drug charts, include blood pressure medications, paracetamol, zopiclone, and morphine. His vitals are stable, but he's very drowsy. So how would we look into, obviously, after doing an A2E assessment, what would be the most common cause for a low GCS in this case? What do you think, Latif?
So, Christian, a very nice case, and I think it's a useful case because unconscious patients are often one of the reasons why people end up being referred to critical care. And as we have said so far, when we refer to critical care, or whether we do or we don't, our responsibility as medics is always to ensure we have done our part. So we have done our ABCD and we have done our own medical management. So with unconscious patients, a structured A2E assessment will always, if we do it in a proper manner, in a comprehensive manner, will always go a long way in understanding what factor is playing a part behind their decreased consciousness level. And with this patient, it can be due to any reasons, isn't it? So for example, if we do an ABCDE, is the patient actually hypoxic? And if the patient is hypoxic, is there a problem with the airway itself? In a B assessment, has the patient actually developed any carbon dioxide retention? Is that a carbon dioxide retention secondary to a lung problem? Or is that a carbon dioxide retention secondary to not breathing properly? And if the patient is not breathing properly or hypoventilating, why is that? What is the patient's blood pressure? Is the patient actually hyperperfusing his brain? Yeah. So we go to C. So what's the circulatory status? Then we go to D. What D is very important in any unconscious patient. So we should always start with the blood glucose levels. Yeah. So is the patient actually hypoglycemic? The most important thing. If it's not hypoglycemic, if it's not a hypoglycemia, then we look for focal neurology. Is the pupils unequal? Is there any obvious side which is not moving? As soon as we find some focal neurology in somebody who's got a low GCS, we should focus a lot on the intracranial causes. So for example, has the patient sustained a stroke? Patient did have a fall. Did the patient actually sustain a head injury? Has that led to intracranial hemorrhage? If there is no focal neurology and the BMs are okay, we should still not go to E. Rather, we should always finish our examination by doing a quick sign for meningism. Meningitis may often be missed in the elderly patients, and we need to do our basics first before we rule out meningitis. So always check for meningism. And then finally go to E. And E-wise, is the patient hypothermic? Do a quick whole body examination. Is there any evidence of any sepsis anywhere, any skin infection or joint infection? Look at the patient's notes. Look at the patient's drug chart. The patient was on multiple medications which can sedate the patient and reduce the respiratory drive and reduce the GCS as well. So has the patient got an excess of morphine? The morphine that the patient is getting, is that compatible with the patient's renal function? So the patient may be getting the same amount of morphine, but had a drop in the EGFR. How much Zopiclone was the patient given? So a lot of these things will play a part, but you should be getting an answer within 10 minutes if you have done a proper comprehensive ABCDE assessment.
The peri-RS team arrives and his pupils are very small. It's noted in the drug charts that he's had 30 milligrams of morphine in the last 24 hours and his GFR is currently around 20. So it's decided that this is likely opioid overdose and he's given naloxone 400 micrograms and the patient actually starts recovering consciousness and is more alert. After it is decided that he should be sent to one of the acute medical wards in case he does need a naloxone infusion. But again, the patient's wishes are respected and escalation is not thought to be needed to intensive care, but they wouldn't consider that in case he loses his airway, but there's no risk of airway compromise. So I think this type of case shows how even if a patient is not for escalation to level 2 or level 3 care, that there are still interventions that we can do on the ward in order to make sure that we deal with all the causes of an unconscious patient.
Absolutely, Christian. And there's another thing I just wanted to quickly put into context, that escalation and ceiling of care, in my opinion, should not be a blanket decision. Because if you clearly looked at what we talked about, one of the important questions is the reversibility of the condition and the exit point. So if there is an intervention which has a clear exit point, so you know the patient needs an intervention for a reversible condition and the intervention has a clear exit point, which means that once you do the intervention, the patient will clearly come out with no repercussions on the patient's overall, you know, long-term outcome, and the patient has no chance of being harmed. But that intervention can only be offered at a particular place away from the ward, then I feel that should still be offered. So for example, if you need a particular type of treatment that you can only give outside AMU, in this case, for example, you know the patient has a clearly reversible cause of morphine overdose, nothing else going on, and all the patient needs is a bit of 24 to 48 hours of naloxone, probably, if an infusion actually is needed, but that can only be offered away from AMU, yeah, then we should have a rediscussion, because just because the patient is not for escalation beyond AMU should not mean that now when we have reached a situation where we believe there's a clear exit point, we should withhold ourselves from offering that. But again, it goes back to the original concept that the four pillars of ethics, it all starts with autonomy. So any escalation has to clearly be consistent with what the patient has given us consent for. So while patients cannot demand higher levels of escalation, which are against their medical best interest or they're against medically what is deemed appropriate, but they can refuse treatment. And if they have capacity and they refuse treatment, we can't do that. So again, it just goes to show how many different factors play a part in escalating somebody to ITU. But we just have to have an overall holistic picture rather than follow some set rules, if that made sense.
That makes perfect sense. Thank you so much. Thank you for this excellent talk. And I think it's going to help all our listeners, especially internal medical trainees that are still learning and deciding what type of medical registrar they're going to be. And obviously, it's going to be helpful during their own course. So thank you so much, Latif. It was an excellent podcast. And thank you for joining us once again.
No, thank you, Christina. It was my pleasure. And I really loved being able to talk on this because I feel really passionate about this. And this is related to my everyday practice. So I really, really enjoyed this podcast as well. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for listening and join us again for the next episode next week.